This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Final Days, written by Nathan Heistad and Jasper T. Scott, performed by Ray Porter. 1. Roland. Light peeked through Roland's drawn curtains, blinding him temporarily. He glanced at the clock at the bottom right of his center monitor, seeing it was already 8 o'clock. When was the last time he'd eaten? The bowl of half-empty cereal 4 feet away had turned to mush, telling him it had been hours. He spooned the remnants of warm milk and oats into his mouth and continued scanning through the files.
"Come on, Raleigh. You're so close. Keep going," he told himself, blinking his sore eyes.
The living room had become a makeshift office. Screens were mounted along the wall behind the desk, intercepting news feeds around the world. Roland shifted in his chair, scanning between the monitors. The volume was off, but the graphic images clearly depicted riots in Botswana as toxic fog thickened, rolling across South Africa from the Indian Ocean. People were dying by the thousands, and only half of that number stemmed from the terrible disaster. The next screen showed hail falling in Iran. Snow blanketed half of Egypt, and people were screaming that the end of the world was nigh. Roland watched the third monitor as a light coating of ash fell over Paris, a precursor of what was to come from looming eruptions in Iceland's active volcanic network. Roland had guessed this was coming. Since he was a teenager, he'd followed the erratic weather patterns, and all of it led to this day, this doomsday, as the media was so apt to name it. A convergence of numerous, horrifying events could only mean one thing, and Roland thought of the phrase, "the cataclysm of Earth."
"And what do you have to say?"
Roland asked the man in a cheap suit and a trench coat on the news feed, standing outside Yellowstone National Park, fear stamped on his face. He flicked the volume on and observed with interest. "When the Yellowstone supervolcano is affected by the tremors, it will erupt, along with a series of volcanoes along the Pacific Rim. Tsunamis will wipe out Hawaii, along with the entire western coast of the United States. Japan has already begun their evacuation." Roland turned it off and focused on his work. An email popped up from his source, this one through untraceable channels, and he wondered if they'd finally found the information he'd been searching for. No. It was a video feed from right near his own home. The feed was live, and he watched as the streets filled with people. Looting had begun. Police lights flashed as they marched down San Pedro Drive in riot gear, fending off attacks. Roland stood, heading to the window, and spread the blinds apart with his fingers. The sun was almost below the horizon, and he caught a glimpse of it off the water. Here in Newport Beach, things still seemed civilized and normal, at least from the view of his waterfront house. He wondered what his grandmother would have thought about all of this. She'd been so headstrong. She would have stayed here until the tidal waves tore her home from the ground and dragged her out to sea. Roland wasn't going to follow her lead. He glanced to the side of the room where a bag sat packed. He had a plan, but he needed something first. One more email, one last detail, and he'd be able to make his move. Roland went to the kitchen, bringing his empty bowl, and searched for something edible. Dishes were piled in the sink, and he really wished he'd hired a maid, but he couldn't trust anyone inside his house. Not with all the classified information stored in the computer system. Nope. This place was sealed tighter than the Pentagon. He brewed a pot of coffee, hoping the caffeine would spruce him up, because his head was beginning to swim. The countless shipping manifests and spreadsheets he'd been combing through were affecting his vision. With a steaming cup, he made his way to his desk, turning off all of the news feeds so he could focus. He clicked a document closed and spotted a folder on the desktop. He clicked the letters TSP for Top Secret Project and retrieved the file he wanted. Inside were details on the billionaire Lewis Hound and a scattering of blurry pictures of the man. He was rarer than a unicorn and photographed about as well as the Sasquatch. Roland zoomed on one in particular, seeing the short black hair, stoic thin face, the expensive suit, and dark sunglasses covering his eyes. He was at the water, but where? His contact had sent him this, and he wondered if Pied Piper 19 had taken the image themselves. Lewis Hound owns Trickle Source. Trickle Source is the parent company of Aquaticoli, whose website indicates them as a third-party boat parts distributor. Roland documented the steps of the supply chain out loud. It was a habit he'd had since he was young, and it always helped him through a problem. Aquaticoli has received shipments from 5 major overseas robotics manufacturers, as well as from Boeing and Bombardier, but there are no signs of where the product went after that. There was a string of details he was skipping over about shell companies, publicly traded corporations, and private consultants, but all paths led to one person, Lewis Hound. He stared at the man's indistinct image for another minute, and something clicked. He fumbled through his files, searching for something that he'd seen a long time ago but had brushed off. A town's name that suddenly felt like it was important. Roland's hands shook and his heart raced. Pulling a key from the chain around his neck, he unlocked a drawer on his desk, revealing 5 pill bottles. He reached for the left one and dropped 2 small capsules in his hand, flicking them into his mouth and swallowing them dry. He found what he was looking for on a 2-year-old shipping manifest, destination Cape Town, California. He hunted for another and confirmed the same destination from the same trucking company. Roland cracked his knuckles and did what he knew best. He hacked into the trucking company's website, finding easy access into their internal software program. 2 hours passed before he discovered a long list of jobs ending at Cape Town. Their pickup locations were all over the country, likely trying to hide something, but the product needed to end up there. The satellite view made available to the public showed nothing but coast at the address given on the manifests, so Roland sneaked into NASA's database instead, combing the coordinates. His heart beat so fast he thought a bird was trying to escape its cage inside his chest. He'd found it. The warehouse shown on the screen was immense and had a private dock near the ocean. There were no signs of vehicles or boats nearby. The image was from satellites, only 12 hours old. Bingo, Roland smiled as he leaned back in his seat. He had a destination. His smile broke as another message came through from Pied Piper 19. Payday. The subject meant his contact needed funds before sending the final details. This was it, what he'd been waiting for. He accessed the dark web, finding Pied Piper 19 on his list of contacts. He sent the cryptocurrency and hoped it was worth it. With the world ending, he didn't really worry about money any longer. Anyone looting stores for things beyond water, food, and medication was a fool. The speakers chimed and Roland bent forward, elbows on the desk as he ran his hands through his thick, shaggy hair. Once he saw the message, there was no going back. He opened it, only to discover a countdown to a date, September 30th, 2029. Only 10 days left. Roland leaned over the desk, his fingers trembling as he captured a screenshot. 2. Andrew, 10 days left. Metallica blasted from the aging speakers of Andrew Miller's Silverado. The windows were down and warm air was rushing in. To Andrew's left, on the other side of the highway, he could see an endless ribbon of white sand running like a gleaming river beside the rippled blue canvas of the Pacific Ocean. A clear blue sky domed the world. To his right, Atop dry, rocky hills, wealthy neighborhoods and ocean view mansions peered through a messy wall of power lines. Andrew glanced up at those mansions from time to time, wondering if their owners were all just as stupid as his ex-wife's husband. It wasn't long before the transition from Santa Monica to Malibu was complete. The homes on the right had descended to block his view of the beach and water in a hodgepodge parade of capitalistic pride. Traffic clogged the highway and he began crawling along, never exceeding 20 miles an hour. Andrew smirked and shook his head as he studied those mansions. None of them had any kind of yard, no greenery of any type, and not even enough space between the houses to be able to walk between them. And the real kicker was that all of them backed right onto a busy highway. This was what had attracted so many of LA's rich and famous? Well, they could have it. Selena had probably thought she was trading up when she divorced him and remarried with Dr. Michael Lewis. Andrew snorted and shook his head. All she'd done was find a bigger box to live in and a bigger asshole to share it with. Traffic went from a crawl to a dead stop, and Andrew slammed his horn with his fist in frustration. Someone else echoed his sentiments a few cars behind him. Every other week he made this trip to pick up his daughter, Val, and every other week it was the same. An hour there, an hour back. At this rate, they were going to miss the movie. Andrew caught a glimpse of his eyes in the rearview mirror and realized that he was scowling. The beginnings of a familiar dark haze were descending on him. He turned the music down, then muted it entirely and began to practice his breathing exercises. It had been a while since his last visit to a therapist or support group, but now that he was divorced, why bother? Besides, even his therapist had admitted that there's no cure for PTSD. All you can do is treat the symptoms. The traffic began inching forward again, and Andrew noticed that every other car passing on the other side of the road was a Tesla. He snorted. Figures. A warm breeze blew through the cab of his 15-year-old Silverado. She was a gas guzzler and hell for the environment, but at least if he had an accident, he'd know it was his fault and not because of some bug in the latest autopilot update. After half an hour of crawling along, Andrew finally turned off the highway and up into a hilly residential area, with oversized homes squatting on every available inch of land. Fancy sports cars and luxury sedans were parked on both sides of the street, leaving barely enough room for one lane of traffic. These homes had more green space, but not by much. At least they had the view, though. Within a minute, he reached the end of the cul-de-sac where Dr. Lewis's mansion sat. It was a pretentious monstrosity with Roman columns and gold doors.
Ridiculous in every way, just like him.
Andrew pulled into the sloping driveway, boxing in Michael's Tesla Roadster and deliberately tapping its rear bumper.
Oops,
he smiled. He realized he was being childish, but he couldn't help feeling like Michael deserved it. With all the stories Val had told him about the guy, he was lucky Andrew didn't put a fist through his plastic face. Andrew opened his door and jumped out, striding up to the golden doors. He deliberately ignored the video intercom and knocked loudly instead. A few seconds later, he heard clipped footsteps, heels. The door swung open and Selena appeared. Andrew's heart skipped a beat.
Andrew, finally!
She smiled faintly as she said his name. She was wearing a see-through summer dress that accentuated her natural curves and revealed a bikini underneath. Her long chestnut brown hair draped over her shoulders. Striking brown eyes blinked slowly at him, and her smile faded. That smile could put a man on his knees. He would know. He'd been there and done that and had the bruises to show for it.
Is everything okay?
Selena asked.
Yeah. Sorry, just tired. Is Val ready?
Selena crossed her arms over her chest.
She's been ready for an hour already.
Sorry, I got tied up in traffic.
Don't tell me. Tell her.
Andrew bit his tongue and smiled thinly.
All right, I will. Would you get her, please?
Come on in.
Selena spun away from the door and walked inside. So you can rub my nose in your millionaire's lifestyle? Andrew wondered as he stepped across the threshold. He didn't bother to shut the door behind him. Let all the flies come in and sit on Michael's shit.
Val,
Selena called as she strode away from the foyer and out of sight. Andrew glanced about. Expensive-looking art hung on the walls. There was an office to the left and a sitting room to the right. The main living room and kitchen were on the other end of the hall, facing a wall of windows and a stunning view of the ocean that Andrew could see clear from the entrance of the house. A modern crystal chandelier hung from a high ceiling above the entryway. This place had to be worth at least $5 million.
I guess that's your price tag, huh, Selena?
Maybe that wasn't fair, but as far as Andrew was concerned, it was the only way to explain it. Michael was a balding plastic surgeon a decade older than her. Of course, he didn't look 10 years older. With bleached blonde hair plugs and two separate facelifts, he resembled a retired Ken doll. Valeria came into view, striding ahead of her mother.
Hey, Dad,
she said. They collided in a brief hug at the door, and he kissed the top of her head.
Remember, you have homework, Selena said. You've got that essay on climate change to do.
Val rolled her eyes.
As if writing about it is going to stop it. Besides, this is bigger than that. We don't know what's going on. It doesn't matter. You need to keep your grades up, especially if you want to get into MIT like we've been planning.
Val snorted and shook her head.
Newsflash! MIT is going to be gone along with everything else. Have you even been watching the news? People have been talking about the end of the world forever, Val. This is nothing new. It must be really dark under there.
Selena shook her head, eyes narrowing swiftly.
Under where? The giant rock you live beneath?
Selena blew out a breath and glared at Andrew.
You see how she talks to me?
Val brushed by him on her way out the door.
I'll be waiting in the car.
Andrew stood frowning in the entrance.
What are you guys talking about?
Selena sighed.
Some geology professor published a study about the San Andreas fault line, and now there's a bunch of copycats all over the world spewing the same doomsday rhetoric about other fault lines. It's just fear-mongering. We've been here before.
Yeah, we have,
Andrew admitted. A few times, in fact, he did his best to avoid the news, but lately it was almost impossible not to hear about all of the strange things going on. Hail in the Middle East, toxic fog rolling in from the ocean and killing hundreds in Africa, massive earthquakes in Asia and Indonesia, Mount Etna blowing its top, Iceland's volcanoes sending ash as far as Paris. Now, apparently, the paranoia was spreading to the good old U.S. of A.
Make sure she writes that essay,
Selena intoned, her hand on the door.
No problem, Andrew said.
When he made it to his truck and climbed in behind the wheel, he noticed that Val was smiling wickedly at him from the passenger's seat.
What?
You put a dent in the roadster's bumper. Mike is going to kill you.
Andrew smiled and barked a laugh as he backed out of the driveway.
I'd like to see him try.
By the time they finally reached the Edwards Calabasas Theater Complex, got their popcorn, and found their seats, the movie was already 20 minutes in. Both Andrew and Val were completely lost, so they passed the time making fun of the plot and bad acting.
Shut up, old man,
a guy behind them hissed. Andrew frowned. He and Val were only whispering. He turned around and glared at the guy. The complainer was just a kid, maybe 16. He was wearing an Armani t-shirt and sitting beside a girl who was obviously way out of his league. He probably thought his parents' money made up for that.
Tell you what, kid, how about you go fight a war in Afghanistan, watch an RPG, turn your buddies into spaghetti, and then you come back here and tell me to shut up.
The kid's lips twisted into a smirk, and the girl beside him laughed nervously.
People like me don't fight wars,
the kid said.
We make people like you do it for us.
The dark haze had returned, and suddenly Andrew couldn't breathe.
Dad,
Val whispered. She put her hand on his arm. That grounded him, but only slightly. He turned to face the movie screen with a scowl and dug a fistful of popcorn out of the box he was sharing with Val. Laughter rippled out behind him. If one of those kids kicked his seat or threw a piece of popcorn at him, he was going to lose it.
"Let's just watch the movie,"
Val whispered. "Yeah, okay." Fortunately, the rest of their time in the theater was uneventful. Maybe that kid realized how close Andrew had been to tossing him into the aisle. Or maybe the big man upstairs was protecting him from himself. The kid's parents would press charges for sure, and that was the last thing Andrew needed right now. On the drive to his place after the movie was over, Val came out of her shell.
"Mike was drunk again last night," she said.
"I see," Andrew said. He wasn't sure what to say to that. He didn't like the idea of his daughter living under the same roof with an alcoholic prick, but he wasn't in a position to judge. Then again, maybe he was. At least he was working on it. He could feel the weight of the green 90-day AA chip around his neck, hanging beside his dog tags from the thick silver chain that Val had bought for him last Christmas. She was so proud. That was what kept him sober. He couldn't let her down. She caught his eye with a mischievous grin.
"He fell in the pool and took out his iPhone."
Andrew chuckled. "Classic Mike."
"I might have stuck out a leg to help him," Val added. "But my culpability is debatable. He shouldn't have been pacing around the pool and texting after having that many gin and tonics."
Andrew snorted and shook his head. "Did he notice?"
"Maybe. Who cares? Plausible deniability. I was reading my Kindle, and I didn't see him coming. Just like he didn't see me."
Andrew snorted and shook his head. It was nice to have someone on his side. Val lived with her mom because the court had ordered it, not because she liked Selena better. They stopped behind a stream of cars at a red light, and his daughter's words echoed through his head.
"Mike was drunk again."
So what else does he do when he gets drunk? The light turned green, and Andrew tapped the gas pedal to follow the blue Toyota Prius in front of him.
"Most of the time he fights with Mom."
"And you?"
"Sometimes. He yells about stupid shit like wearing my shoes in the house or forgetting the cereal box and milk on the kitchen counter. At first I did it by accident, but now I do it to piss him off."
"You shouldn't provoke him."
"Really, Dad? Pot, meat, kettle, you're black too."
"Has he ever laid a hand on you?" Val laughed.
"If he did, I'd break it off."
Andrew smiled. "That's my girl."
"I'm hungry,"
she said. Andrew checked the time on his dash. 10 o'clock. "Not much is going to be open at this time."
"What about pizza?"
Val asked.
"Domino's stays open till after midnight."
Andrew smiled, his stomach already growling at the thought. "Domino's it is." 3. Kendra. 10 days left. The air was crisp as Special Agent Kendra Baker sneaked into the rear entrance of the squat building. It was getting late, almost 10 p.m., as good a time as any to break into the target's den. It was dark inside, only a handful of the hallway lights were on. One of them flickered ominously as she headed past it toward the staircase. She was accompanied by two heavily armed LAPD SWAT members, and they flanked her as she followed them up the stairs. The carpet was stained brown in blotches, exposing the entire place to a sickening smell. They arrived at the second story, and her heart rate picked up. She was overheating, drops of sweat cascading down her side under the heat of her pantsuit and bulletproof vest. The male SWAT officer lifted a hand, and she stopped as a door beside them opened wide. Kendra swung her gun around, aiming at the dark shadow in the doorway. It was an old man, his wispy white hair sticking straight up. He raised his arms, yelling something in Mandarin.
"Keep it down,"
Kendra hissed through her teeth at the man, motioning him back inside. He disregarded their orders and followed them at a distance as they kept moving. Months of investigating the smuggling ring had led them here, and Kendra wasn't about to let this one be blown. Even with all the crap going on outside, she needed this case to be a win. Kendra stepped over a bag of garbage and wondered how anyone could live in filth like this. She wanted to scrub her hands clean and take a hot shower, but she pressed on. A bullet struck the wall beside her, and her local escorts began firing their semi-automatic weapons down the hall. Seconds later, the entire floor was silent.
Kendra glanced behind her and noticed the old man had returned to his suite. "Front of the building's quiet. What's going on up there?" a voice asked into her earpiece. It was her partner, Peter Costella. He always managed to stay out of danger in every altercation. It was his superpower.
"Shots fired, but the halls are empty. We're going in,"
Kendra said, and took the lead, walking over broken glass as they arrived at another door. She assumed the light was shot out, as it was almost pitch black in the hall. The number 203 was labeled with cheap plastic, the three hanging upside down as one of the screws was missing. Another shot rang out, and the female SWAT officer staggered sideways. Kendra pressed herself against the near wall and fired her Glock toward the attacker. One, two, three pulls. And even in the dimly lit corridor, she could see the target slumped to the floor.
"Are you okay?"
Kendra asked the officer, and she grunted in reply.
"Good shot,"
she told Kendra, and they moved on, arriving at a doorway. This was what the dead man at their feet had been protecting.
"There could be more inside," the officer said. "Be ready."
He stepped away, lifting his thick leg. The door sprang open with his kick, slamming toward them as it swung quickly back on the hinges. He tapped it again, and they rushed inside the room.
"Hands up! Hands up!"
Kendra yelled, and scanned over the 10 or so young girls' faces, lit softly by the glow of a solitary lamp at the edge of the room.
"Where are they?"
The SWAT officers ran through the few messy rooms in the suite.
"It's clear."
One of the girls was crying, and Kendra walked over to her, not sure if the girl spoke English.
"Where did they go?"
The girl lifted a shaky arm and pointed out the door down the hall. Kendra took off toward the other staircase and heard muffled footsteps. She moved faster, the heavy rhythm of the LAPD officers behind her. The target entered her sights, long dark hair pulled in a ponytail, flapping erratically as he ran for the door. She needed him alive. These were at best low-level scumbags, but they would lead to the real source of the smuggling.
"Stop!"
she commanded as he pressed through the glass doors, heading straight toward the waiting officers. Kendra arrived just in time to see the man hit the concrete, skidding to a stop. Blood pooled beside him while her partner stood a few meters away, gun raised and a smile spread over his stupid face. Instead of confronting Peter, she avoided him, hoping they hadn't wasted the last 2 months to emerge empty-handed. A short time later, the girls were wearing blankets and were ushered toward an ambulance in front of the building. This hadn't been a waste. Lives had been saved today, and that was good enough for Kendra. It had to be. Kendra was surprised by the applause from the City Center East precinct as she and Peter entered the building the same moment that the clock struck midnight. It gave a sense of finality to the day, and she was spent. The local office's sergeant came over and shook her hand, then Peter's.
"Great work, you two."
"Thanks for the assistance," Kendra told him.
"We're more than happy to help the feds,"
he said with a smile. This, of course, was a lie. The local departments always bristled when she stepped anywhere near their people or cities. It was an unwritten rule for the PDs to be uncooperative with the agency. She'd given up fighting it years ago. Her initial naive attitude at being a special agent had been washed away with the years and far too many deaths. Lately, she just rolled with it, trying her best to keep her head above water. Today had been rough. Peter was grinning ear to ear as the locals talked to him, patting him on the back. All he'd done was wait for her to run the guy out the door and then pulled a trigger. She'd been the one inside with all the risk. What did it matter? A woman watched her from near the coffee maker. So familiar. Kendra ignored the sergeant's comments and walked away.
"What's her problem?" the man asked Peter.
"Nothing. She's a little off," her partner said.
So much for the unwritten rule of partners. The woman had chestnut brown hair, longer than her sister's had been. Maybe dyed. Kendra had to stop this. This wasn't Carrie. Carrie was gone. The woman poured herself a coffee and turned, smiling at Kendra. She was at least 10 years older than Kendra's sister would be, and bore no resemblance to her.
She needed to stop fabricating ghosts.
Everything okay? Peter asked from behind her, making her jump.
I need to go to the hotel and rest,
she told him, and he nodded. He tossed the rental's keys at her. Go for it. I'm joining them for a celebratory drink. You sure you don't want to come? Her partner asked.
His eyes were squinting, his hair receding into a thin gray mat. The thought of celebrating alongside him was disgusting. He'd killed their only lead. But to be fair, she'd shot the other one.
No, I'll see you tomorrow. We leave at 8:00, be in the lobby, she told him.
From the look in Peter's eyes, she fully expected him to be there in the morning, having not slept and trying to mask a headache. She left him there, taking her time on the unpredictable roads to the hotel. Sirens rang in the distance, and twice she had to come to a stop to let mobs of people pass. They were walking the streets with casual disobedience, and she hated what was happening to their society. 3 times in the last decade, the fear-mongering news networks had riled everyone up, making them think the world was ending, and each time they'd made it through with nothing more than a minor hurricane or earthquake. Kendra didn't believe the hype, not for 1 minute. She eventually arrived at the hotel, and like every time, she wished they were staying somewhere nicer. For once, she'd like to be at the Ritz-Carlton. She parked in the lot, noticing most of the cars were absent. It had been 3/4 full earlier in the day. The neon sign flickered between vacancy and no vacancy, and Kendra glanced at the crappy bar to her left, then toward the rooms. With a huff of her breath, she followed the sound of men talking over a cigarette outside the bar.
I'm telling you, this is for real. My cousin knows a science dude at Berkeley. Says this whole section of the country will be underwater in a week.
The man leaned against the brick wall, 1 foot planted on the building. He tossed his cigarette butt to the ground, and Kendra stepped over the burning stub.
No way. This is all a bunch of crap the government feeds us every few years. They probably want us to leave so they can wire our houses or some bull, the other man said, lighting another smoke.
Kendra walked past them without comment and pushed the bar's heavy door open. It was almost 1:00 and the place was nearly empty. A man and a woman were playing pool, standing at impossible angles, displayed only by those with enough drinks in them. Kendra took a seat at the bar, the surface sticky under her elbows.
What'll it be?
The bartender asked. She almost laughed when she saw him. He was the epitome of every small-town bartender in the U.S. 30 pounds overweight, prematurely gray hair, and a mustache that cried out for a comb. She peered behind the bar and noticed the smudged glasses.
Beer, in the bottle, she said,
and the man nodded. The TV behind the bar was playing a newscast, and she watched as it showed a map of the U.S., and a simulation of predicted tsunamis from the Pacific as they rolled over the West Coast. Swirling hurricanes hit the East Coast, and the supervolcano in Wyoming shot ash over the rest of the country.
This is messed up.
The bartender passed the beer over, and Kendra took a sip.
Which part?
She asked, feeling the tension of the day melt away with each tick of the clock.
What do you mean? They're evacuating the city,
the man said.
This was news to her.
Where'd you hear that?
Just now, on the TV. Guess it's not enforced yet, only precautionary or something. I got nowhere to go, he told her.
Where are they saying is safe?
Kendra asked.
They don't have a solution. Guess the best shot is Texas. At least that's what they're saying.
The bartender glanced around and poured himself a double whiskey, slamming it back with a smack of his lips. She didn't blame him. He thought the world was ending.
What are you doing here if you believe all this?
He shrugged.
Like I said, I got nowhere else to go. Even if I headed to Texas, those sleazy hotels will be charging crazy rates to stay. The greedy bastards are going to take every red cent they can.
Kendra couldn't argue with him. He was right. A commercial ended, and the broadcast started up. The volume was low, but she read the scrolling banner. Dozens missing in California.
Mind turning this up?
She asked, and the man did so without hesitation. He leaned against the bar, finding her another beer and taking one for himself. Her first was still nearly full. A woman in a professional blue dress was interviewing a man inside a home office.
"And why is the police department not taking this seriously?" she asked him.
"They don't have the resources, manpower, time, you know, the usual runaround," he told her. "Let's face it, missing people are always low on the totem pole. These aren't kids. For the most part, they're professionals, adults."
The woman nodded emphatically.
"And why do you think they've been taken? How can you assume this is nefarious?"
"My sister calls me twice a week. She's never missed Sunday dinner, and yet here we are. She's gone. The hospital hasn't seen her, her friends haven't heard from her, and her social media is silent. Her cell phone was inside her condo, along with her purse. I'm the only one with a key," the man said.
"We wish you the best of luck, Dan. If anyone has any information about Dan's missing sister, or any of these other people,"
24 photos adorned the screen,
"call this number."
Kendra took another pull of her beer, feeling the effects. It was making her sleepy. Missing persons, and many of them from her hometown of San Diego. She picked up her phone and sent an email to her office asking to be placed on the case. Her sister might be gone forever, but maybe she could find someone else's.
4. Andrew, 9 days left. By the time they finished eating their pizza and pulled up in front of Andrew's place in West Adams, it was just after midnight. His place was an old two-bedroom bungalow with peeling paint and sagging gutters. It had a tiny yard out back and a paved one-car driveway running alongside a patchy lawn. A humble abode, if ever there was one. But it was close to the garage where he worked, and in a relatively quiet neighborhood. Besides, rent in L.A. was insane, and a nicer place would have been out of his budget. Andrew killed the headlights and the engine and climbed out with Val. He slammed the door at the same time as she did, and they walked up the front steps together. He yanked the screen door open and spent a minute fumbling with his keys in the dim yellow glow of a flickering bug light that illuminated his collapsing front porch. Finding the right key, he unlocked the entrance and swung the ancient wooden door open with a noisy creak. There was a rusting, aftermarket metal frame bolted around the grid of single-pane windows in the top half of the door, but Andrew was pretty sure that a determined thief could easily rip those burglar bars out of the rotting wood. "After you," he said, and waited for Val to go in first. Andrew shut the door behind them and locked the deadbolt with his key. Kicking off his shoes, he angled straight for the living room. He flopped into the couch with a tired sigh, drawing a beleaguered groan from the aging springs. Reaching for the remote, he flicked on the TV. "Feel like watching our show before bed?" he asked, craning his neck to search for Val. He heard a can of Coke click open and noticed her standing in front of the open fridge.
"Sure, I'll put my bag in my room and get changed," she said.
"Okay," Andrew replied. She had plenty of extra clothes here, so the bag was probably for her homework. She was a straight-A student, honor roll, and that was all the more impressive, considering she went to one of the best schools in Malibu. She was just too damn smart. "That's my girl," he thought with a wistful smile. He flicked absently through the thumbnails of different shows on Netflix, looking for the one they'd been watching together. There, Hempel's Paradox. The thumbnail was a picture of a black raven picking apart a green apple. Val said it had something to do with the name of the show, but whatever it was, Andrew didn't get it. A lot of the show went straight over his head. It was a soapy, cerebral drama that, if he was being honest, he wouldn't have watched in a million years if it weren't for Val. His daughter returned a couple of minutes later wearing her black skull print PJs and carrying a fuzzy pink blanket. She sat next to him and spread the blanket over both of their laps before curling up under his arm.
"It's freezing in here," she said. "When was the last time you paid the heating bill?"
"There's a heating bill?" Andrew deadpanned.
"That explains it."
"It's cozier this way," he said. "Ready?" Val nodded, and he hit play. His mind began to wander as the show's brainy main character, Val's favorite, launched into a breathless monologue. The character's sidekick-slash-romantic interest was hanging on her every word.
"Must be nice," Val said.
"Hmm?"
"To have a guy look at you like that."
Andrew turned to regard his daughter with one eyebrow raised.
"Are you speaking about anyone in particular?"
"No, Dad."
That sounded like a lie, but he decided not to press. He remembered what his therapist had said.
"If you want your kids to confide in you, you can't pry too much. That only shuts them down."
At least that had been Andrew's experience.
"So, there are no boys you like at school? Is that prying?" he wondered.
"They're all idiots," she said. "Either they want to pay me to do their homework for them, or they want... well, you know."
"Yeah."
He tightened his grip around Val's shoulders and kissed her on top of her head.
"You tell me if you need any help scaring them off."
She flicked a wry smile at him.
"So you can go into Hulk mode and wind up in jail?"
She shook her head.
"No, I can handle them by myself, thanks."
Andrew frowned and nodded absently, his gaze settled on the TV. That quip hurt, but he wasn't sure if Val understood why. His temper was half of the reason Selena had left. He'd never hit her, but she'd said more than once that she was scared of him. It wasn't really fair. Selena had known about his temper going into things. They'd met in a hospital while she was tending his broken hand. The kids in the bar had provoked him, 3 against 1, and they were the ones who got to press charges. It wasn't his fault that they'd never managed to land a solid blow. The Marines had taught him how to fight, and because of that, he'd wound up looking like the guilty party.
"Hell of a justice system we have," Andrew thought. Old wounds burst open and feelings of resentment and frustration flooded in. A familiar feeling of helplessness followed and quickly spread. Gunfire and screams rattled through his brain, distant enough to be a memory and not an actual hallucination, but it triggered him all the same. He shut his eyes to black it out. Bad idea. His brain filled the blank canvas behind his eyelids with a pink mist, and suddenly he was there, in the back of that Humvee again. He could taste the blood and sand in his mouth. A loud ksh roared through the ringing in his ears, and an explosion pounded through the vehicle with a razor hail of shattered glass. Andrew's eyes flew open, and a scream tore from his lips. He could have sworn he felt the scalding heat of the flames licking off the hood. Val was shaking him.
"Dad, are you okay?"
He was staring at the TV without blinking, his heart slamming in his chest. A feeling of isolation, horror, and despair clutched him, making it impossible to breathe. It was as if the memory of that RPG round had been powerful enough to knock the wind out of him and bust his ribs all over again.
"Breathe, Dad. Just breathe, okay? It's not real. You're safe. You're here with me. It's over."
He could hear the fear and pain quaking in Val's voice, and it cracked him in half, but he couldn't just snap out of it, as Selena used to say. After a minute, the feelings passed on their own, and he sucked in a deep, calming breath.
"What happened?"
Val asked. Andrew shook his head. It was usually hard to identify a meaningful trigger. A lot of times it was simply a feeling, or even a hot day and a dose of dehydration. One minute he was fine, and the next he was in the middle of a full-blown panic attack. He was supposed to be stronger than this. He was a Marine, damn it.
"I'm sorry," he breathed.
"It's okay,"
Val replied, but the disappointment in her voice was almost enough to send him running to the liquor store.
"It's late. Maybe we should go to bed,"
she added.
"If you want," Andrew replied, trying to hide his own disappointment. Most nights he had trouble falling asleep. Staying asleep was a problem, too. His days might be troubled, but his nights were haunted. In his dreams, everything he kept pushing down came bubbling up, and suddenly he could see his buddies' faces and hear their screams.
"We can hang out again in the morning," Val added. "We have all weekend."
Andrew nodded and rose with her from the couch. Val hung onto his arm as they shuffled down the hall to their bedrooms. He felt like an invalid or a child. It wasn't right. Val shouldn't have to take care of him. Again, the bottle beckoned. He could taste the bitter heat of a good single malt sliding down his throat and the blissful numbness that followed. His mouth watered and he absently reached for the chip around his neck. Val's gaze flicked to him and he jerked his hand away. Too late.
"Do you need me to keep your car keys?"
she asked. He shook his head.
"Get your shit together, Andy." "No, I'm okay. Just reminding myself how far I've come. It's taken me 90 days of agony to make it here. I can't throw it all away now."
Val was studying him, trying to measure how much willpower he had left. He turned and kissed her on the cheek.
"Love you, V," he said.
"Me too,"
she replied. Half an hour later, he was staring at his bedroom ceiling with his thoughts racing and a pair of sleeping pills busy dissolving in his stomach. Darkness veiled the room like smoke. The yellow glow of streetlights pooled on the floor around his blackout curtains, and he lay listening to the not-so-distant sound of police sirens and traffic. 5 or 10 minutes later, a fire truck screamed by. Sometimes he wished he could pick up and leave it all behind, find a quiet place somewhere far out in the country where he could fall asleep, listening to the crickets and wake up to the birds. Far enough from the madness that he could stick his head in the sand and the world could fall apart and he wouldn't be the wiser. He'd get a little boat and take Val out fishing out on the lake. They'd raise chickens and grow corn, live off the land. Andrew drifted off dreaming about that fantasy of him and Val floating on that lake, their fishing poles dangling over the side of a canoe into mirror-clear water, paved with evergreen reflections. A muffled crash woke him. His eyes flew open and he lay frozen in bed listening to the distant rumble of cars on the nearby highway. A minute or two passed, and then a subdued thump followed. It sounded like the kitchen windows sliding shut. Had he left it open? Andrew sat up in a rush with his pulse pounding in his ears. He slid the drawer in his nightstand open and carefully removed his Sig Sauer P320 from the drawer. It was a dumb place to keep a gun with a kid in the house, but he'd forgotten to move it to his wall safe before Val came over. Good thing, too. He didn't have time to punch in a combination right now. He pulled back on the slide to arm the gun and stood up from the bed. Keeping the weapon aimed at the floor, he padded barefoot to the door and pressed his ear to it, straining to hear through the distant wails of police sirens. He could have sworn he heard someone's step on the creaky floorboard in the hall. Was that Val getting up to go to the bathroom?
Only one way to find out.
Keeping the gun out of sight, he spared a hand for the doorknob, took a breath, and then yanked the door open in one smooth motion. A shadowy silhouette stood frozen in front of him, wearing a black ski mask and dark clothes.
"Hey!"
His Sig snapped up and the figure darted out of the hall. He pulled the trigger a split second too late and the bullet crunched into the wall where the man had been a second ago. He sprinted after the burglar.
"Dad!"
Val cried. Her door flew open just as he raced past it.
"Get back in your room and lock the door,"
he called after her as he reached the end of the hall and saw the burglar vaulting over the kitchen sink and through the open window. Andrew's gun snapped up for another shot, but the man ducked out of sight too fast. The trespasser still had to climb over the side fence. That gave Andrew a chance. He ran for the front door. Broken wedges of glass glittered on the floor beside his shoes. He swiped his keys off the rack beside the coat closet and stood in front of the door with shattered glass cutting into his bare feet. In his drugged state, he missed the keyhole and plowed his hand straight through the broken pane of glass. A searing heat lit his hand on fire, but he pushed the sensation aside and tried for the keyhole a second time. This time the key glided in. He turned the lock, ripped the door open, and slammed through the screen door just as a shadowy figure went streaking past the back of his truck. Andrew stopped in the flickering light of his porch and took aim with both hands. Bang! The bullet crunched through the wheel well, and the burglar darted around the tailgate and out of sight. Andrew cursed under his breath and flew down the steps after the man. The glass shards stabbed with each step, slowing his progress. A wash of dizziness coursed through him as the sleeping pills won out over the adrenaline flooding his system. He stood leaning against the bullet hole in his truck, squinting blurry eyes towards the street. No sign of the invader. He shook his head and stumbled back up the steps. The screen door banged behind him. This time he took care to avoid the bits of glass in the entrance.
"Dad?"
Val asked in a trembling voice. She was standing in the hallway looking terrified.
"I told you to stay in your room," he growled as he shut and locked the front door. "Call the cops."
"What happened?"
Wordlessly, he strode through to the kitchen and slammed the open window shut. The latch wasn't broken, so he must have left it unlocked.
"You're hurt!"
Val cried, seeing the glistening trail of bloody footsteps he'd left in his wake. She ran over to him, and he turned to her with a grimace, suddenly aware that he was still holding a gun. He flicked the safety on, ejected the clip, and then cleared the chamber with a blood-slicked hand. There was a nasty gash in the flesh of his palm where he'd raked it over the broken window. Once the gun was safe, he set it on the kitchen counter with the clip and the bullet from the chamber and began washing the blood off his injured hand.
"I'm calling 911,
Val said.
"Sure, tell them we had a break-in."
An hour later, they were sitting on the couch. Andrew's hand and both feet were bandaged, and his eyes were half-lidded with the residual effects of the sleeping pills he'd taken. A police officer was staring unhappily at him, asking him to repeat his story for the umpteenth time, but Andrew was having trouble focusing on the man's voice. Blue and red lights strobed through the screen door, flashing off the jagged glass in the entrance and making the smeary mess of blood he'd left on the floor gleam brightly.
"One more time, please, Mr. Miller. I realize it's late, but please try to focus."
"I've already told you everything,"
Andrew snapped. His eyes swam out of focus and his head lolled to one side. He shook his head to clear it, and the policeman glanced at Val with a frown.
"Has your father taken anything or had anything to drink?"
She shook her head.
"No, he's 90 days sober."
The policeman arched an eyebrow.
"You sure about that?" "I'm 97 days sober, and yes, she's sure,"
Andrew said.
"I took a couple of sleeping pills, that's all."
"You mind if I see them?"
Andrew pointed over the back of the couch.
"End of the hall, last door on the left, bedside table."
The policeman headed off in that direction, and his partner came to take his place, standing with a thumb hooked in his belt and one hand resting on his firearm. Andrew scowled up at him. Cop number one returned a few seconds later, holding an orange plastic bottle of prescription sleeping pills. He rattled the bottle a few times, nodding his head.
"Ambien. My cousin used to take these. Then he started sleepwalking. Then one night he sleep drove his car straight into a telephone pole and woke up with his head on what he thought was his pillow. Turned out to be the airbag."
Andrew shook his head.
"What's your point?"
The cop looked to Val.
"Did you see anyone in the house?"
She hesitated, then shook her head.
"Did you hear anyone come in? Or a window breaking?"
Another shake. Andrew felt a sick feeling flutter in the pit of his stomach. It wouldn't be the first time the justice system had screwed him over.
"Hey, that's not..."
He trailed off as a stabbing headache flared behind his eyes.
"We found no signs of forced entry besides the damage to the front door, but you said yourself that the intruder didn't come in there because he couldn't unlock the door without the key. We examined the window that you said the burglar came in through, but there was no sign of forced entry there. And the neighbors didn't see anyone climbing over the fence or running away from your house."
The policeman pointed to Andrew's bandaged hand.
"Here's what I think happened. You were sleepwalking. You grabbed your gun, fired at an intruder only you could see, and then cut your hand when you plowed it through the glass in a clumsy attempt to unlock the door. Then you fired a second shot at your imaginary friend as he ran around the side of your truck."
"I've never sleepwalked in my life," Andrew said coldly. "I don't have the history for it."
"You live alone, right? And these pills were prescribed 2 weeks ago, so how would you know if you sleepwalk or not?"
Andrew scowled and slowly shook his head, even as he began to wonder if that was possible. He was definitely still half asleep. Beside him, Val bristled and stood up with her arms crossed over her chest.
"Okay, well, if that's true, then there's nothing else to do here," she said. "Thanks for your time."
The policeman shook his head.
"I'm afraid it's not that simple. We're going to have to arrest your father."
"For what?"
Val shrieked. Policeman number two grabbed a pair of cuffs off his belt and took a long step toward Andrew. He jumped to his feet beside Val and swayed unsteadily for a second.
"On what charges?"
"Negligent discharge of a firearm."
Turn around and put your hands behind your back, sir. Hang on, what about my daughter? You can't just leave her here on her own. Cop number one looked to Val.
You have somewhere else you can stay?
My mom's?
We can give her a call and wait here for her or give you a ride. Up to you.
A ride would be faster, Andrew said tiredly. She lives in Malibu.
This is so stupid,
Val muttered.
I'll call another car to come pick you up, cop number one said. My partner will stay here and wait with you until it arrives.
Andrew scowled as cop number two locked the cuffs around his wrists. He caught Val's eye.
I'm sorry about this, Val. I promise I'll make it up to you.
She nodded uncertainly, and then her gaze slid away. Maybe even she was beginning to think that he'd imagined the intruder.
Lewis.
Lewis held on to the railing of the floating docks and stared over the roiling ocean to the darkening horizon. The water was black, frothing from the looming storm. The sky hung close overhead, the clouds thick and purple. The air practically crackled with tension. It was the middle of the day, but it seemed like midnight. This storm was like a harbinger for everything else that was coming.
The end of an era and the beginning of a new one, he thought.
A purple flash of light cracked the sky in half, jagged and wide like a fissure in the earth. The heavens had their own version of tectonics, and they were bumping elbows now. A distant rumble of thunder accompanied the slash of light, and Lewis began to feel the first pitter-pattering of raindrops landing in his hair and on his skin. He stared at his bare arms, turning them over a few times, to watch as fat drops shook the forest of hairs on his arms with strange tickling sensations.
"We don't have much time," Eric Keller said. Lewis flinched, startled by the voice. He'd forgotten Eric was there.
He turned to look at his project manager and second-in-command. Eric was short, small, and thin, with an obsessively trimmed beard that he thought could hide his weak chin. There was a sharp gleam in his shifty, dark eyes. This was a man who'd never been exemplary in his life, but who'd always secretly suspected that he was anyway. Now he'd been elevated to a position of power, confirming his arrogant assumptions of unrecognized greatness. He was an idiot, easy to fool and manipulate, which made him perfect to be the public face of this facility. Not that anything about it was actually public.